Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, it is my honor to be in dialogue with Dr. Yaakov Nir. We will be discussing his newly published book, The Establishment and History of the Cyprus Detention Camps for Jewish Refugees, 1946 to 1949, published in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, United Kingdom, by Cambridge Scholars Publishing, 2023. Dr. Yaakov Nir was born as Nes Tziona, the child of newcomers to Palestine. He studied at Rishon LeZion High School and at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He is a marine geologist who has studied at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Johns Hopkins University, and the University of Gothenburg, Sweden. Yaakov, it's an honor to be with you today.
It's my pleasure too.
To begin, please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired the scholar you'd become as an adult?
It's quite a big of a project. I should try to concentrate on the main points of my biography. My first 15 years, I was living, of course, in Siona, and it was under the British mandate. In simple words, it didn't like the British, although if I compare their behavior towards the Jewish Yeshuv, the Jewish community of Palestine, 1948 was around 620,000 people, was much better than that of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. But this is not important for the description of my book, but still, we hated them. They refused to allow us to get to Palestine. They were mainly Ernest Bevin, foreign minister of Italy, that followed Churchill, 1946, 1948. But despite that, the Jewish community was quite independent in regards with education, language, although the white paper of 1939 was mostly devoted in order to limit the possibility of immigration on the one hand and of purchasing land on the other. I never participated in demonstrations those days because of the fact that I was in a small village, but practically, the Palestinian Jewish community was always in a bad condition of relations with the British. Although during the World War II, more than 35,000 Jews were drafted to the British Army. Later, after finishing high school, I went to the university, to the sciences, and in one of your questions, you asked me how come that I was going to a certain part of the academician or academic studies. It has been perhaps my nature by asking questions, trying to understand why do we have flies? Why do we have bees? How does the orange grow or grows and so forth? The first year was general studies from A to Z, biology, geology, meteorology, mathematics, and whatnot. And then after the second and third year, we started to have just pure geology. At the same time, we had lots of field trips. We participated in the mapping of the entire Negev. Negev is the southern part of Israel, the triangle that goes from the Dead Sea, the Sea of Aqaba, Gulf of Eilat, and the Gaza Strip, which is more than 50% in size of the state of Israel. Later, I was sent by the Geological Survey to have 1 year of studies at the Johns Hopkins, which gave me a good basis for understanding sedimentology, and 4 months in Denver, Colorado, 40 days in field trip with Ralph Imley, the late, returning to Israel. And after a while, I was drafted to the Department of Marine Geology. This was a very, very pioneer study of the sediments of the bottom of the Israel offshore of the Israel's Mediterranean Sea. I did some studies with others in Lake Tiberias and the Dead Sea, which was then somewhat still alive. At the moment, the Dead Sea is dead. I also taught at the Haifa University, at the maritime section, and I participated in 3 cruises to the Eastern Mediterranean and also far back to Sicily. The most important section of my sea studies is the study of the coast. As a geologist, the 12th in the desert, in the Negev, you come, you look for an outcrop, you study it, you come back home and you write. The advantage or the beautiness, if I could put it this way, of the coast is that whenever I get to the coast, I find and locate something new. It is a mobile phenomenon. Sometimes the sea is quiet. Sometimes the sea is wavy. Winds, blocks are falling from the cliff. Sands are moving. Sands are accumulating and so forth. I have spent at the Geological Survey of Israel for about 40 years, inclusive my 2.5 years in the army. When I retired, 1998, after a wonderful sabbatical time in New Zealand, I started to, let's call it, relocate my memoirs and decided that I should pay my debts to my father and to my grandfather and start studying Cyprus. During my studies of the agricultural little farms of Jews in Cyprus, I have met with Podomos Christou Papavasiliou, whose picture is in the front of my book. And this fellow, Greek Cypriot, wanted to write his biography. So whenever we have met, he told me, please, while you are in London at the Kew National Archives of the United Kingdom, please do copy files that deal with the immigration to Palestine during the British Mandate. And as a good friend, I did, and I copied for him maybe 30 or 40 or 50 files. I've sent it to him and I expected him to start writing. When I saw that he's doing nothing, I offered him. I told him, please let me come and stay with you a day or two. We should prepare. As a scientist, I did have much more experience in writing than a fellow that never wrote anything besides commercial letters. He said, I'm doing very well. I am advancing. In Yiddish, there is a verb which is called, that's what it was doing, a sach mitnoch. It did nothing. 2015. By the way, we visit Cyprus at least twice a year. We love the land. We love the people. They are still people. So we were sitting with his son, Christakis, in a good fish and shrimps restaurant in Limassol. And he told me, you are the only one that can do that. I said, what? He said, write a small chapter about my father. So I got into the files, which practically I have never got inside them. And I've seen that as a geologist, I am facing a gold mine. I remember the period. I remember the events, not in details as are appearing in my book, but I remember almost everything. So it was much more easy for me to get and start writing. And after something like a year or two, I got a manuscript of more than 400,000 words, which is, I think, even much more than the Holy Bible. And I started to look for a publisher. The United States publishing houses are beautiful. They ask you for $10,000. If they accept the book, they will deduct it from the original sum. If not, you lose the money. Being the grandchild of Rockefeller, I couldn't afford it. So I started to look for other publishers, and by chance, I found the Cambridge Scholars Publishing, who is situated in Northern England. They are so nice, so polite, so helpful. The only limit was that I've got to let my paper to one of the references who works for them, but is not a part of the team. And they have chosen Lawrence Fenton from Cork, Ireland, who is an historian. He corrected the manuscript. Ah, by the way, I forgot to say that they said from the beginning that we are not printing more than 200,000 words. So I've got to be King Solomon and cut the baby. I decided that I can have it as immigration to Palestine during the British mandate until the point when the refugees were captured on the boats, re-embarked on British boats, and were sent to isolation and to detention camps in Cyprus. So this is why I've got two books. The first one is, as I said, perhaps this will be better.
Thank you for showing it.
And the second is the book that we are dealing with at the moment.
Thank you for showing. Thank you.
You can do it also at home.
What inspired you to write this book? What message do you hope to convey to your readers?
I know that nowadays there is a big competition between paper and television and Facebook and handbook and so forth. I know that many people are avoiding reading on paper. I belong to the generation who really loves printed words on paper. But as long as my generation is going to the second world, my readers, or the list of my readers, is getting down, not just myself, is getting down and down. Especially that as a scientist, I try to be correct. I have never left some question or some title that I didn't try to look and find out who was he, what did he do, why did he do what he did. So it is, my books are very basic. For those who would be interested in the history of the pre-times of Israel, on the one hand, and the history of the post-war immigration to Palestine and the detention camps of Cyprus. I have also had last year presentation of my book that was operated, I would put it this way, by the Israeli ambassador to Cyprus, Oren Anulik, who did a wonderful job by presenting my book. Historian also was commenting about my book, and it gave some push, although because of the fact that my books are so expensive, many people cannot afford this sum, although the first book was already printed in soft cover, and the price is 50% of the original one, which is quite feasible for people who would like to study something of the conditions, and especially my two books concentrate on the British point of view. Many books were written about Aliyah Bet, second immigration, illegal immigration to Palestine, but practically no one has written in such a detail the book from the British point of view. What happened in London, in Cyprus, in Jerusalem? How did the high commissioners behave towards the Jewish community, towards the Jewish immigration? Were they cruel? Were they nice? Were they so and so and so? I also have a good chapter about Turkey, although I wrote something about the Armenians, but this is not the topic of my book. The Armenians genocide that started already in 1895, and refugees arrived to Cyprus. Turkey was playing a very rough, very ugly play during World War II. 1942, a wrecked ship by the name of Struma arrived to Constantinopolis, to Istanbul. They didn't allow them to buy food. They didn't allow them to land. They didn't. This was a ship which could carry 5 people. I'm exaggerating, of course. And there were 1,760, something like that, on board of the ship. Those were refugees from Romania that were starving for life, running away from both fascists in Romania and from Hitler. And the Turks didn't allow anything. And at the end, they said, although the British also behaved not like angels, at the end, they pushed the Struma to the Black Sea, and it was torpedoed by a Russian submarine. One guy survived. The British at the end, when they were starving at the Istanbul harbor, told the Turks, we can absorb the youngsters up to the age of 17. Please allow them to disembark and they will go by train to Palestine. This was a nice step by the British. The Turks refused, although you can find now articles about Cyprus camps that are written by Turks. The only truth in those articles is perhaps the name of the university and the name of the writer, of the author. Otherwise, Turkey was a paradise. Turkey doing so poor, what not? I really am not too happy with what they have done or what they could have done and they refused to. It's not just Struma, it's all over. The Greek Cypriots, many were working in the camps. The camps were in two bundles. 4 camps north of Famagusta. Famagusta is a city at the eastern side of Cyprus, facing Syria and practically also a bit Israel and some, well, that's enough, Syria, Lebanon, and Israel. 4 camps were erected there. Some of the camps were already existing, already in World War I, but this is not important. When the first refugees arrived on the 13th and 14th of August, 1946. They stayed in hot tents, Indian tents. I found the foundations of some of them. They appear in my book. Terrible, Cyprus has got terrible summer. Not in the mountains, not in the Troodos, but down in the plains. They suffered. Don't forget that they came from Europe, which is much more friendship, say, friendly to the human being. Anyhow, the good British, and I'm not laughing, good British decided that they should build winter camps, and they have did it in a quick time, and they have erected one and two and three until they erected six camps in the Kenya Xilothimbo. Well, at the end, there has been, I think, eight over there and four in Famagusta. And there has been one after a while, one just for children. Large percentage were orphans from both father and mother. Some were orphans from either mother or father. And practically, they were quite fair, although there were fences, barbed wire fences around the camps. And at the beginning, they didn't allow people to walk and see friends and see family and see anything that you just think of. Only after 7 months, they have erected a bridge, which appears on the outside cover of my book. A bridge that connected the camps that were on both sides of the main Larnaca from Augusta Road. At present, most of the area is covered by the British, the camp, the British independent, let's call it, camp, that one of two or three that exists after the 1960 convention that the Cypriots were forced practically to accept the existence of British soldiers on their land. So the camps were opened, and the British were fair enough not to be in the camp inside itself, only at the outskirts. In guard towers, in the center for the manager of the camps, the commander of the camps, but not inside. Therefore, it has been some type of independent camp that was practically directed and managed by the Palmach and Paliam members that were either smuggling to the camps or were going to Cyprus with the refugees. Palmach and Paliam were practically independent, well, belonged to the Haganah. Haganah was the institution that was erected more than 100 years ago in order to protect the Jewish community against the Arabs. The Arabs were slaughtering, killing many times, and the Haganah slowly developed to become an underground army that most of the organized community of the Jews were members of. Palmach was a striking hand of the Haganah that was established by Yitzhak Sadeh. Paliam was the maritime section of the Palmach. The Paliam were the people that accompanied the boats that left European harbors, either officially or at night. So they were the people who organized in classes. Teachers came from Palestine, nurses and doctors came from Palestine, professionals of education, painting, gymnastics, and so forth came from Palestine, and some were from the refugees themselves. Many of the refugees were educated in Jewish schools in Europe and New Hebrew. And this is a story that can last forever. They also were not educated, but were assembled for training in order to get to Palestine and fight for the Jewish independence. Although after, well, Ben-Gurion and the provisional government declared the independence of Israel on the 14th of May, the mandate 48, the mandate was over on 15th, one day later. That's when the last High Commissioner Cunningham left from the High Court, British, as if playing neutrality, did not allow all youngsters, men, from the age of 17 to the age of 35, to return or to go to Palestine, to Israel, although Israel existed as an independent state. And they were not allowed to do that, but they did, as if obeying United Nations decisions. That in theory, the truth, both sides are not supposed to change anything in regard to wind power. Although the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Syrians, the Lebanese, the Iraqis could do that easily. They were connected to the land and they really limited the chance of Israel to survive. And for that, I think that we don't have to forgive them because of the fact that we were quite in bad shape.
Can you tell us about the Armenian refugees in Cyprus who came there between the Hamidian massacres and the Armenian genocide? What were their experiences like in Cyprus? What is similar and different about their experiences to the experiences of Jewish refugees in Cyprus from the Holocaust?
Look, it's a good question, but practically there was not any contact between Armenians and Jewish refugees. The Armenians is a very small community, much united and very advanced educationally. Until about 10 years ago, they did have a high school at the outskirts of Nicosia, of Lefkosia, the capital. Many of them are professionals, academicians, and so forth. There is practically no connection. Besides the tragedy of both nations, the real Holocaust of more than, I guess, 2 million Armenians that were massacred with very cruel system. This was a rehearsal for Hitler how to behave towards the Jews. Therefore, I don't think that it's an important. I have put it in my book just because of the fact that I found this small chapter important in order to show that Cyprus was a paradise to some extent for refugees, even though most of them just passed by and left. But still, the British were quite good and honest and made some limitations, but still accepted that idea that people should come and find salvation for a certain time. The Duperhot, well, I don't know. Okay.
How likely was the possibility of Nazi Germany invading Cyprus Crete?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to answer you before you've asked the question. The Jewish community of Cyprus at the beginning of World War II or Second World War was comprised of two communities. The original, if I can put it this way, people that lived in Cyprus for 20, 30, 50 years or more, and the refugees that came in the 30s. At the beginning of the war, when Italy joined Germany, most of the men of the newcomers of the 1930s were arrested by the British, enemy citizens, enemy alliance. Some were also delivered to the mountains, to the Troodos Mountains, and they stayed in Prodromos and other villages. In quite, I would say, this was after the British have discovered that those people suffered from Nazism, and they are not going to be any threat to the community of of Cyprus, 1941. So Crete was captured by parachutists and others in a few days. And by the way, many Palestinian Jews who were in the British army were captured, but luckily they survived in the German, not refugees, but prisoners' camps. Anyhow, Cyprus practically was not prepared for war. There has been nothing to protect Cyprus from invasion. An occupation could have been in a few days. The British were aware of the fact that the Jews are not a cup of tea of the Germans, and they might be all slaughtered. So they had decided to send out to Cyprus wives of British soldiers and officers, Polish refugees, and Jewish refugees. This was done in June of 1941. First of all, they came to Palestine. There's been many Palestinian Jews with Palestine passport that were coming back to Palestine, remained in Palestine. But the rest, besides the few that ran away, that didn't want to go to Africa, were sent to British Eastern Africa. And some of them did not return to Cyprus until 1946. It's hard to believe. Most of the orange groves, those who have had them, were kept by Greeks or Turks, and they were not dried up. But it was a very nice step from the British governor, or whatever you call him, to decide and evacuate those people. In my book, there is a telegram that was sent by those who arrived to Palestine praising the British for their help and the action of evacuation. This is worth copying.
Can you tell us about the pre-existing Jewish community in Cyprus before the influx of refugees? What can you tell us about the pre-existing Jewish community of Nicosia and Larnaca?
Well, Larnaca, I should start with Larnaca. Larnaca, when the British came after the Berlin Convention of 1878, Larnaca used to be the main city of Cyprus, practically. All the consuls, all the ambassadors were sitting in Larnaca. It has a good harbor and perhaps important to some extent community that allowed it to become the first city. So the major Jewish community was in Larnaca. And they've just discovered that in 1896, there's been 20 Jewish pupils in the elementary school of Larnaca, community of about 40 or 50. Also, the first high holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, was celebrated in 1879 in Larnaca, not in Nicosia. The Nicosia community started to be developed later on when people decided to be close to the government. So some families moved to Nicosia, very few to Limassol, singles to Paphos in the west. So these were, as you said, the main two communities of Jews. Some were industrialists, some were farmers, mainly orange groves. In the 1930s, Palestinian Jews came to Cyprus, the citrus, a branch of agriculture, and planted many orange groves, mainly west of Limassol, in the Fasoria Peninsula, or Cortile Peninsula, till see some of the orange groves that were planted by Jews. But these were mainly because of the fact that the labor in Cyprus was not from any Zionistic idea. Continue, monsieur. I didn't understand.
Can you tell us about Britain's plans to establish additional camps in Kenya in addition to what it had already created in Cyprus?
Well, the Kenya solution for refugees was even earlier, the British said or has had the idea that if they embark the refugees and return them either to the port of embarkation or to further on countries in the, or the globe, this wave of immigration will stop. So they were looking for some camps all over the British Empire. They've also had an idea to send them to Tripoli, Libya, and there has been an idiotic, stupid idea to send them to Fiji Island. Kenya said, camps, Ekutz Vailumi, Essel, and Lehi, Lohamei Sherut Israel. It's unfair not to say that they were much more harm to Palestine, to Israel, other than victories. Anyhow, they said, let's send them to Kenya in 1940, refugees to the island of Seychelles, not Kenya, but many against it because of typical problems in Kenya and people and so forth. And they have decided at the end that site was a small particular one, very close, one light sail, very easy to guard, very easy to construct. And at the end, we know that Cyprus was the only place people were detained. Some were detained for 2 years, others were detained for half a year. The quota for Cyprus was 350 people and above. This was 50% quota according to the White Book of 1939, McDonald's White Book. 75,000 in 5 years, and 1,500 a month. And they continued it until the end of the mandate. So Cyprus, if in Cyprus you've had 15,000, or after they arrived, the two pound ships were both whales, 15,000. If you subtract 750, it's nothing. Burden on the British budget. It was burden on the, I have forgotten to mention the Jewish, did a wonderful job in the camps. Did all the management of food and covered all the expenses of the teaching and medicine. No, it practically was a combination of putting hand to hand of the Palmach, Palyam, Haganah, Rothenberg provided teachers, the joint, the helps, and so forth. And this was, I would call it, proud and brilliant chapter of the pre-state of Israel, all of the poor Holocaust survivors and the Jewish community of Palestine.
Can you tell us about the intended evacuation of the Jewish community of Cyprus in 1941? What specifically happened? How did this unfold? What were the reasons for this, referring to June 1941 and the intended evacuation the Jewish community of Cyprus?
No, you said in the 1970s.
1941.
Well, with the exception of few refugees that appeared, refugees came to Cyprus. There are some small boats, some small numbers, 12 Romanian, some other. Most of the refugees came in the 30s. They ran away from Austria, from Czechoslovakia, and some from Germany. Many were well-to-do. They had to, I don't remember the exact number of maybe 100 sterling, and they were allowed to embark in Cyprus. They were very active until they were arrested and sent to the mountains in 41, and then sent to Palestine and to British East Africa, Tanzania, Nyasaland, and so forth, North Rhodesia, and Uganda, hiding practically and stayed in Cyprus. But the majority of the both communities, the newcomers and the old community, were evacuated. And the reasons are very simple, as I told you. Hitler, and then the British were worried that Cyprus a very short time and has been a danger to those communities. There's no reason to repeat it.
What forms of cooperation existed between local Greek Cypriot nationalists and detainee leaders in the Cypriot camps?
It's a good question. It's your questions. Particularly the Greek underground, Euka, came to get ideas from the Haganah and mainly from the Palmach. They were helping the Palmach in the tunnels and so forth. And on the other hand, they got very good lessons in sabotage and so forth. The Palmach sabotage was mostly against the ships. And this is a very important chapter. Yochai Bin Nun and others, most of them are not with us, with us anymore. So this was some type of cooperation. And the Greeks were very, very happy, although in many extents, they behaved much more cool than the Haganah. The Haganah always tried in Sabbath not to kill eight civilians, but the Cyprus underground was much more violent, to the sorrow of many present Cypriots. Well, by the way, the Cambridge Scholars Publishing Group on time, one book, the second book, in soft cover, cheaper, out to something like $50 or $60.
Wow.
I never know.
Thank you for sharing that.
Beg pardon?
Thank you for sharing that.
Edith, what did you say?
Thank you for sharing that.
Ah, thank you for sharing. Well, but as I said, only students of this special epoch of the Middle East, only scholars concentrating on Mondays in the East, Cyprus and so forth, will be interested in my book. Although, to my opinion, it should be in every Jewish library in the Northern Hemisphere. It is a chapter which is practically, from my point of view, which is the British point of view. But you cannot force the horse to drink the water. You can just bring collision between two types of Jews, the European and the North African. And I didn't get into the details, but perhaps according to many other things and so forth. And it's not, well, look, I have done it because of the fact that this was a chapter, like I have done, and about the ugliness either of the groups, of the cooking groups, of the filthy kitchens that they have had. And they didn't change their habit until children were dying. They put not just the nice face of the people, also the, it's not ugly, but the nice. I tried to concentrate on all data that I've had, not all, practically, I've chosen, not so easy to decide which one is going to be thrown out and which one is going to be included. So the British informed decided to put it in a book which is just flowers. It's good for botanists, but not for historians. Know what I mean? Ari.
What new information is presented in this book regarding the Palmach and the Palyam?
Well, in the Palmach and Palyam, let's put it this way. The British have deciphered the code of the wirelesses of the Palmach and Palyam. And in practice, they have known all the way to Palestine. They knew where the boat was embarking, they knew who was the captain, they knew so many things. We have discovered it only after that. But in Cyprus itself, in the camp, we didn't use wireless, only for connection with Palestine. So Palma, who played the major part in the camps, were known not 100% to the British. For instance, Johann B. Yosef Ledror damaged one of the reporting vessels, was caught by the British. He ran away from jail and entered the camps, and they didn't discover him. And later on, he left through the tunnels and with an underground small vessel arrived to Caesarea, which used to be one of the main centers of the Palyam. So without Palmach and Palyam, there practically hasn't been any big movement of Jews, of Holocaust survivors from Europe to Palestine. They did all the steps from the camps, refugee camps in Eastern, in Central Europe, to the deported, to the embarkation ports, and they had, they were youngsters. Just imagine, they were 18, 19, and 20, 21, that they've got to solve very, very serious problems. And they did it much better than the present Israeli government. These were babies, also in the camps. Yigal Alon was the best, not just fighter, but commander of Israeli Defense Forces. In 1948, was 27, general at the age of 27. So these youngsters did the Bricha, the escape movement, from the first spot to the embarkation. And they were helped, of course, by some strong refugees, Holocaust survivors, who spoke the language of the country that they were passing through, who spoke Yiddish to the survivors and so forth. So this was a combination of the Palmach, and the refugees.
There are four primary camps that your book discusses: Dechelia, Karaulos, Famagusta, and Zulatombu. What were the similarities and differences between these camps in terms of their geography, the detainees, size, conditions?
They were not too far from each other. Karaulos is north of Augusta. Dechelia, Zulatombu are on the main road, on the Larnaca, Augusta main road. And they have developed much more the Dechelia or the Dechelia, Zulatombu camps rather than the Karaulos camp. Karaulos camp, I think that you should include the oblique aerial photograph showing the Karaulos camp north of Augusta. The Kenya, they have developed it step by step. And whenever there has been a necessity of, let's say, 200 more recent huts, they have done it so quickly. And the main idea was to have a safe and good shelter for winter. Winter is very cruel in a tent. It's not the best place to live. So there were fair enough to try and bring as many as recent huts to Cyprus. And all the pictures of the camps shows mainly recent huts. They were in rows. Also in recent huts, it hasn't been a hiccup. Couples, families were at least, let's put it, hiding beyond the, I would say, cloth. Something of a sheet of a, or some other types of isolation. But still, there's been no private personal life. But compared to a tent, these were perfect. Everything in life is relative.
What is your book's contribution to Holocaust studies and the history of the Holocaust?
I wouldn't say that it is a contribution to the Holocaust studies, but it is a contribution to the Holocaust survivors, to those who survived the Holocaust, who entered this tunnel or this pipe that started accumulating in Eastern Europe and ended in Palestine and so on in Cyprus. So it's not a study of, I would say, endemic or speciality of the Holocaust. It started as a study of refugees, and that's how it was developed.
Can you tell us about the hunger strikes that took place in the Cyprus camps?
Yeah.
Can you also tell us about demonstrations that occurred in the camps?
Of course. I've mentioned earlier that the quota for Cyprus was 750. The Jewish agency, which I have forgotten to mention, practically was a center for the organization of the Palmach, Palyam emissaries to Europe, the Haggadah. And the Jewish agency have got a problem. The European quota was 750, which was not enough. And many of the Jews, I would say that most of the refugees were not Zionists. And I'm not blaming them. Many wanted to go to the Western world, to America. And the Jewish agency was worried that they would lose newcomers. We starved the Jewish community of Patterson, starved for people, starved for youngsters. And if those or these will go to France, England, and the United States, they will be lost forever. And by the way, most of the refugees went to the United States, only some to South America. So they decided to squeeze a bit I would put it this way, to deduct the 750 refugees to come to Palestine from Cyprus and donated it to Jewish refugees in Europe. So the formula in Cyprus of first come, first goes was harmed, was not kept. And you couldn't explain them why this Jewish agency has done it. So they demonstrated, and demonstrated quite heavily. They also demonstrated against the joint, and Laub, Moritz Laub, didn't have any other solution, but he ran away from the camp. And he told them, if you're not behaving nicely, if I can put it this way, I shall not return. This was another strike. The solution came from Golda Meir, who was in the Jewish management, or one of the leaders of the Jewish community of Palestine. And she was brave enough to get to the camps. She spoke both good English. When they left the Ukraine, they went to Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and she studied English. And then she emigrated to Palestine. She knew Russian, she could talk Yiddish. So she spoke to the leaders and to the camp dwellers. And she explained them that this is a necessity, that they should suffer a bit. And the formula of first who comes, first who leaves, will be in a deficit. Nobody could tell and know that after the establishment of Israel, the British will not allow them to go to Palestine. Nobody could forecast it. And this brave step of Golda really helped the camps to be more quiet. There were also demonstrations against the British that did not allow them to go.
Can you tell us about the health care and medical facilities available to detainees and refugees in the camps in Cyprus?
Yeah, in short sentences. The British had military hospitals in Nicosia, and most of the births of the children were over there. Some were born in a hospital in Famagusta, but most were born over there. The Jewish agency and the joint provided with medical doctors, nurses, disciples, and they were holding medicine and the health of the refugees. I have already mentioned the refugees were not clean in their kitchens. When some kitchen was dirty, they moved to another place. And they were warned that it will hurt them, but they were not behaving as one should behave in responsibility for the health of the family and mainly the health of the children. And altogether, about 150 people died in the camps and were buried in the cemetery of the village of Margotchiflik, which my grandfather established. Most of the deaths were children of 1 week, 1 day, 1 month, or 1 year of age. Most, and later on, when they kept nice hygiene, the children survived. As I told you, the British didn't take care of anything in the formalities of the inner part of the camps. Only when you came to them and said that Mrs. X is expecting, then they allowed them to go to Nicosia, to the hospital, which practically became into small exhibition of what is left from the camps. And every once in a while there is some ceremony taken on this camp in Nicosia, and just 1 month ago there has been a celebration of the anniversary of the 75th year of the closure of the camps, which was attended by the Israeli ambassador, by the Cyprus president, and many by the Cyprus, by the Nicosia bishop, and by many people who were interested in this chapter of history of the Jewish nation. We can go forever.
Can you tell us about the Habricha organization? What were its activities and accomplishments?
Well, I told you already that the Palmach and Pandyam were arranging it, and they were gathered in empty houses, in hospitals, and whatnot, and were organized by the Palmach, organized by people from their own groups. Many were, by the way, organized by kibbutzim, communal and cooperative farms, already back home in Europe. And they did all the nasty work. You had to pay to the guards in order to allow your group to pass. You had to pay to this and that. But practically, many were going with the group, passing this or another pass between Austria and Italy, for instance, and many left them in the old rich house that was empty, belonged to a fascist or something like that, or to the Rothschild Hospital in Italy. And all of the organizers went back to bring another group. That's how it worked. It worked all along the route from Poland to Czechoslovakia, to Austria, to Germany, to France, to Italy, and so forth. And there is organization by the name Habricha, which is very active today in Israel, and also getting the rehearsal of the routes that were done by their refugees.
Can you tell us about
Kami's escape?
Can you tell us about Operation Agata? What happened and what were the consequences?
Sure. Agatha was a very concentrated operation by the British against the Jewish agency and the Palmach. After few quite successive operations against the British, or let's say Palestine bridges from all around, and other operations, they decided to, I would say, pay a very strong hit to the Jewish community of Palestine, and especially, as I told you, to the Haganah. If I'm not mistaken, something like 20 kibbutzim were captured and investigated. 2,000 men and women were arrested and sent to British detention camps in the south. Most of the Haganah and the Jewish agency directors were arrested and were detained in Latrun. Latrun is on the main way road from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. And practically, they have captured thousands of documents. Also, the document of the personal people of the Palmach in Kibbutz Mizra in Emek Israel. And they have emptied the Jewish agency's library and archives in Jerusalem. So it has been a big hit, but on the other hand, many were later released and restarted everything from the beginning. And that's why we were prepared for the war of independence. They have reported, and because of the fact, in practice, it didn't have practically a direct relations with our relationship to the immigration. But indirectly, it didn't have it. This hit was a big hit to the Palmach. Although those who were in Europe, of course, were not arrested, and the big wave of boats coming from Europe to Palestine was not affected at all from this big hit to the Palmach and the Jewish agents. In practice, they were not sure that the Jewish agency is involved with the immigration. Only after they have caught so much documents, they decided that they were wrong, that they were expecting the Jewish agency to cooperate with them in regards with the stopping of the Aliyah of the immigration. But they had a problem in deciphering the Hebrew letters and documents. They didn't trust people that they will translate it correctly. Only after a while they have found some British Jew or professor, I don't remember his name, that really translated, but it was very slowly, translated the important documents. So this is my play, although I know that I'm not playing.
Can you tell us about where your time and attention have gone since completing this work?
I didn't understand.
Can you tell us about where your time has gone since completing this work?
Yeah, well, first of all, worrying for Israel, sometimes in shelter, and I've written already 20% of my new book on the Jewish agricultural farms in Cyprus. And it helps me just to run away from daily political and Israeli problems. You know, I'm concentrating and I forget of everything. It's perhaps unfair, but this is the only way for youngsters like myself not to remember what's going on.
It sounds like very important work. I can hardly thank you enough. As we bring today's interview to a close, I am your host on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast, Ari Barbalat. Today I've been in dialogue with Dr. Yaakov Nir. We've been discussing his newly published book, The Establishment and History of the Cyprus Detention Camps for Jewish Refugees, 1946 to 1949, published in Newcastle upon Tyne, United Kingdom, by Cambridge Scholars Publishing, 2023. Dr. Yaakov Nir is a marine geologist. He was born in Nes Ziona, the child of newcomers to Palestine. He studied at Rishon LeZion High School, Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Johns Hopkins University, and the University of Gothenburg, Sweden. Thank you very much for your time and generosity.
I really appreciate your time too, and your initiative to make my book perhaps known by more 5 people.
I hope so.
Perhaps more.
I hope so.
At least.